It's here and now. Iraqi government officials are saying they've made an arrest in their investigation into who took the shocking cell phone video seen round the world of Saddam Hussein's death by hanging. Here's a sample of that video. The cell phone recording shows the actual death of the former president and, as you just heard, the taunting and chaos that preceded it, unlike the official video, which was released by the Iraqi government. The person under arrest today for taking that video does not appear to be one of the two men reportedly seen with a cell phone at the gallows. He's the national security advisor to the Iraqi prime minister and one of the most powerful men in Iraq. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Solomon Moore, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And Solomon, Mowafaq al-Rubai, the powerful national security advisor, told Reuters today that he did not tape the hanging, but a prosecutor who was in the room said that al-Rubai had a cell phone, although he doesn't know if al-Rubai took pictures. So what are you hearing?
Well, we're hearing a lot of different versions of this. Of course, the prosecutor at first said that Rubai did have a phone and that two officials were recording this. I'm hearing also from other people who suspect that Rubai did take the footage of the execution as well. Rubai, today, we've been told, is in Najaf. We haven't been able to get in touch with him. I know that the other media here have been trying to get in touch with him as well to clear this up.
Who, then, is under arrest today?
The government's not saying who it is that's under arrest, but what I'm hearing from Iraqi officials is that they're probably going to just arrest one of the guards that crowded into the execution chamber right before Saddam's hanging. And what I've been told is that there's a fear that one of these low-ranking figures will be scapegoated to protect these high-ranking officials who may have been involved in this.
Well, that, you know, is a question. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki ordered an investigation yesterday, but John Burns of the New York Times says, as you've just said, it's unlikely there's going to be many results because the investigation is being conducted by officials of the Interior Ministry, which conducted the executions.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's not a whole lot of accountability in Iraq right now, and certainly, it's not going to take much of an investigation to figure out who was filming the execution.
And also, what is the charge? Is it a crime to film the execution? Some would say this is, you know, arresting the messenger as opposed to addressing the problem, which was the chaos in the room.
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear what crime they would be charged with, but you know, what I'm also hearing is that the Iraqi government wants to also question those who criticize the execution itself, which is kind of chilling when you think about it. A lot of people have been criticizing that execution because of how it was carried out, but it seems that the government really wants to crack down on any sort of, the fallout that's come from this.
Have protests over the execution grown? It had been relatively quiet.
Yeah, there have been a lot of protests around the country, mostly in Sunni Arab areas. They've been generally peaceful protests, and yes, it has been relatively quiet and kind of eerily so. We're trying to figure out what's really happening. I mean, fighting is continuing. We're still hearing about killings taking place throughout the country, but we haven't seen like a huge surge of violence as we did after, other big incidents like the bombing of Sadr City or the bombing of the mosque in Samarra.
Well, while questions remain as to whether or not al-Rubai, the national security advisor, actually took photographs with his cell phone, there is a question as to why he would do that. It would seem as if that would be counter to his interests. Again, top advisor to Nouri al-Maliki, why would he want to disseminate the chaos in that room?
Well, I mean, one person's chaos is another person's celebration. And you've got to know that Rubai, along with many of the top Iraqi officials in government, suffered greatly under Saddam. Their families suffered, their community suffered. In some cases, they themselves were taken in and arrested and tortured. I understand that Rubai had that experience. So, you know, Saddam's execution was a very emotional moment for these people, not just a function of the state, but really a kind of retribution that they've been waiting for a very long time now.
Solomon Moore, Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Well, the death toll of American service people killed in Iraq now tops 3,000. One of the early fatalities was caught on tape before he was killed.
Riding in the back for 3 weeks is like taking a pounding on your ass. Because when you're going slow, going over all this rough terrain, you get tossed around a little bit and it beats the hell out of you.
That's Marine Lance Corporal Alexander Arredondo in April 2003 speaking to NPR about the uncomfortable ride from Kuwait City to Baghdad. Alex Arredondo was one of the first Marines into Baghdad. He came home later that year but was sent back, and he was killed in action in Najaf on August 25, 2004, on his father's 44th birthday, in fact. You probably remember the story of his father, Carlos Arredondo. Carlos was working as a handyman in Florida when the Marines came to deliver the bad news about his son, Alex. What happened next became one of the iconic images of the war. Carlos smashed the window of the Marine van, got inside, doused it with gasoline, and set himself and the van on fire. Marines came to his rescue. He says they were angels in camouflage. Since his son's death, and while recovering from second-degree burns over a quarter of his body, Carlos Arredondo has devoted his time to an almost obsessive mission to keeping his son's memory alive. He drives a pickup with a coffin in the back and a "My Son Was Killed in Action" sign. He also helps other families as a member of the Gold Star Family Project, and he's been a critic of the war. As he says, Muqtada al-Sadr's militia killed my son in Najaf. Now Sadr is helping to run the country. What's wrong with that picture? And Carlos Arredondo joins us now in the studio, and he's brought many photos of his son and other materials he's collected, some of which you can see on our website, here-now.org. Carlos, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you, NPR, for that peace of mind they give to us families.
How is that for you to hear now? I mean, it must have been so joyous for you to hear Alex when he was first there in Baghdad, but now that he's died, how?
At that time, you know, when I hear John Burnett.
That was a reporter, John Burnett.
The reporter was so emotional. Oh, my goodness. I'm still feeling those feelings. And right now, listening to him, his voice, you know, bring me a lot of memories.
Yeah. So now it's a gift. Well, how are you doing? How are you doing physically? How are you doing emotionally?
Well, it's been over 2 years already in trying to put myself the best I can because it's no scripts.
Yeah, no one tells you how to do this.
I try not to make the wrong choices or say the wrong things, but it's so hard, you know, going through all these emotions that we're going through every day, seeing the news, you know, how many more and how many families all over the world suffering the pain of the lost ones and the mess that we all are, you know, and I do the best I can. You know, I volunteer myself right now as a Red Cross volunteer.
You're a Red Cross volunteer?
That's correct. I'm a volunteer for them. Also, I'm a volunteer in the VA hospital in West Roxbury.
In the VA hospital here in Boston.
That's correct. It helps me to continue with my morning, seeing the other people. They're going through their own situation themselves, you know. Thank God that I'm here right now speaking to you and be able to share my story and honor my son and all those veterans all the time, you know.
Well, you know, I want to ask you about that. You know, you say it helps you continue your mourning, and some would say it would help you continue what's become a mission. How would you characterize this mission since your son's death? Because you well know, Carlos, some would say you've become obsessed with your son. We've got all sorts of books here on the table detailing his life. We want to talk about them. Others would say, how could you not be obsessed? How would you characterize this mission of yours?
It's difficult for so many families. The husband, wife, sons, daughters, they're coming back from the war. They developing post-traumatic stress disorder. I see that. I see that in myself.
You see it in yourself?
Yes.
Because your son died and you had that, you know, angry, painful reaction?
For having my son there. Not just by he dying, but just having him there. What I experienced through all that time that he was there watching two TVs, watching the news, and listening to all this, developing some kind of post-traumatic stress that affects families.
Do you think that's what made you react that way that day when the van pulled up?
Yeah, I know it has a lot to do with that.
What did happen that day? I mean, what was it that made you take the gasoline and pour it on the Marine's van?
When they first pulled in front of my house, I thought it was a surprise because my son, he was a joker like that.
Yeah.
I didn't see him around. You know, I asked him, what are you here for? Are you here to recruit my other son, Brian? And they said, no, we're here to see the family. And pretty much that's why they delivered the news right there. And I didn't say anything to them. I just run away. I said, oh, my God. Mm. Since the moment that this happened, I thought it was a nightmare.
Mm. Yeah.
It's the denial. Yeah. A lot of families have that denial of those moments. If they go away, nothing of this happened, life continue. You know, it's just so many emotions.
Well, I know you've since met with those Marines and apologized, you know, for attacking the van. Do you think about, you know, what would have happened if you had died, you know, and your mission is now to honor your son? You would have missed that mission.
I was so close to cross my son's path. Then I find out that everybody got their own paths. I was kicked out in a ball of fire out of there.
You wanted to die with him, but it didn't work.
Well, I don't know. It was not script, but when that dam blew up and threw me in the street on fire, you know, something more than natural happened here.
Yeah.
Thank God, you know, angels wear camouflage.
Angels wear camouflage?
Yes.
Yeah?
I believe in angels.
Well, you also had other issues that you had to deal with at the time. Your ex-wife, your son Alex's mother, was very upset with you. Your other son, Brian, was upset with you. He didn't speak to you for the longest time. I mean, people don't get to see how many layers of problems there are that ripple out from a death like this.
Oh, my goodness. This is happening in so many families across America where the father went to bury the son in Arlington Cemetery. The mother went to bury the son near home because she need to go there. And the father believed the son was the ruin that thing. The mother might believe the war is wrong. So if you think it's hard enough, bury the son or daughter. What I've been learning through other family, my own family, we break apart. Mm. It's very hard what's going on right now.
Mm. Your current wife is Melita. You blamed your ex-wife, your son Alex's mother, Victoria, because she signed the papers that allowed him to become a Marine. And so that was also part of the stew there, the mix in the beginning that, you know, you were angry at her. Have you guys resolved some of this?
Yes, we got to spoke many times about that, and I apologize when I say that. And, you know, we continue, and that's one of the things we got to do. You know, we got to continue. Otherwise, we cannot stay with the same issue all the time.
That's Carlos Arredondo. His son Alex grew up here in Massachusetts, was killed in Iraq in 2004. And when the Marines delivered the news, Carlos set himself and the Marine van on fire. He's recovered since then, obviously. He's made it his mission to both honor his son and help other military families. When we come back, we'll find out what Carlos did when he became a U.S. citizen. Also, quick program note, Mitt Romney formally announced his presidential campaign today. Will voters think he has enough foreign policy experience to solve the problem in Iraq? Much more coming up here now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Carlos Arredondo, a native of Costa Rica, whose son Alexander, actually was one of the first Marines into Baghdad and then was killed in Najaf in 2004. And when the Marines came to tell Carlos, he set their van and himself on fire. You remember that story. Since then, he's devoted himself to his son's memory, helping other families whose relatives have died in Iraq or Afghanistan. And by the way, you may have seen his pickup if you live here in the Boston area. It's got a flag-draped coffin. Outside of this area, you can go to our website, here-now.org, to see pictures. And I've been calling you Carlos because that's what we're used to calling you, but you did something recently. You became a citizen and changed your name. What did you change your name to?
I changed my name after my firstborn, Alexander, and my secondborn, Brian. So my name now is Alexander Brian Arredondo. And for me to honor my boys with their own names, it's wonderful.
You brought some materials to our office before your citizenship ceremony, and we love looking at them. There was a letter that Alex wrote to you. It's dated January 19th, 2003. He's on a ship. He's going to Iraq to fight. I know you have the letter here, the original letter. And he writes, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm more afraid of what will happen to all the ones that I love if something happens to me. It seems as if he knew how hard it would be for you, and maybe even sending you a message to not take your own life, you know, because of what might happen to other people that love you. I'm wondering, what do those words mean to you now?
Oh, my goodness, when I read those words, you know, my God, this is my boy talking, and he's on the way to war. And the last conversation that I had with him, he said, Dad, we've been fighting for over a week. We are very tired. I just want you to remember that I love you and don't forget me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I say, Alexander, I love you very much. I'm very proud of you. You're my son. But then, you know what? He died, and you put all this together with the first letter home, the last conversation with him. There's so much there, you know. That's why I keep all these folders together with me. Every letter that I receive from everyone around the country, I keep it in folders. Mm. I know the names.
In fact, let's look at some of the things that you've got them beautifully encased in plastic in these several three-ring binders. These are other families. Tell me a little about these families. We'll just page through.
Well, in here from Texas, this family, you know, the Belex family, they lost their two sons.
Two sons in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, one died in Iraq and the other one died in Afghanistan.
What's
so,
this over here?
And this mother right here, 45-year-old mother from Arizona, she had a heart attack and died.
She found out her son had died and then she died. Oh, look, that I remember this. They were both buried at the same funeral. Oh, boy.
And my son's letters and everything that I own of him, I keep it very organized.
We have these pictures behind us, blown-up photographs, you know, maybe 3 feet by 2 feet, beautiful photographs of his gravesite, his open casket. In fact, you show these in your work to other Gold Star families. What do they say to you about those photos?
I show these pictures in a mall in Washington,
in a mall,
D.C., and I have a couple of mothers, and one in particular who came to me and was very grateful for me to show her that picture because that was the way she wanted to remember her son.
Why, because she couldn't have an open casket, is that?
That's right. Her son died in an explosion, so she didn't have the opportunity to say goodbye, you know, with an open casket, and that's one of the things that many families, you know, they're going through, you know. But thank God, you know, my family was lucky enough to have an open casket, you know, to say one more last night goodbye.
Well, you know, Alex, as we said, he was one of the first Marines into Baghdad. And we read a little of his early letter, and he said he was ready for the mission. But his view of the war changed over time from what we understand, from what's been reported. He had a brief leave before he was killed. He came home, and he did not, well, you tell me, reports say that he didn't want to go back.
Alexander has his thoughts about go back.
His doubts?
Yes. He was thinking about the family, but also he was thinking about his comrades. And that's one of the reasons why he went back, because, you know, his comrades, they don't want to betray their own comrades.
Their comrades. They want to do it for their comrades.
Yes.
Given that he, you know, he didn't really want to go back. He was starting to show whatever those feelings were. And now we have had the Iraq Study Group report. We have the huge national debate about whether the war is winnable in the way that many people define that word. The national debate about whether it was wise in the first place. How does that make you and, you know, or if you've heard from other Gold Star families, how does it make you feel? You gave a son to this.
Yeah. But, you know, people in Washington, they're trying to figure out right now. The president needs some more time to figure out himself. Sounds to me like they're not too sure what's the next step. Mm. And perhaps playing soccer is one of the suggestions I can give the president of the United States.
What do you mean?
My son called me once and said, we're playing soccer with Iraq when they first got there. You know, they was very happy. Just recently, Iraq win against Korea. The whole country stopped just because of that. And you see that happen everywhere.
It sounds like you're saying perhaps know more about the culture in the country where the troops are.
Yeah.
Carl, do you mind if I call you Carlos?
Yes, too? Please.
I feel like we've done it for so long that I feel I still want to call you Carlos Arredondo, but he recently changed his name when he became an American citizen to the name of his two sons, Alexander and Brian. And he's made it his mission to help other families who've lost a child in Iraq through his Gold Star Family Project. And he's also co-founder of People United for Peace. One last question, Carlos, I have to ask you. Of course, there are so many ironies here that here you are, an immigrant, not yet a legal citizen, whose son dies for America, and yet so many Americans, are talking about closing, making it impossible for immigrants to come. What do you think about that?
As a matter of fact, also number four casualty in Iraq, his name is Juan Antonio Gutierrez. He was the first immigrant who died in this war. He was from Guatemala. And like him, like myself and many other stories, we're here because we have a dream also. And we follow the rules to be here.
Carlos, thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless you.
And again, to see a slideshow of the images that Carlos Arredondo has collected, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, still to come, outgoing Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney today announced he's formally exploring a White House run. What will be the ramifications? Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Today, Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney will file papers to become the latest Republican to set up a presidential exploratory committee. Arizona Senator John McCain and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani have already taken that step. Romney's writing a major victory. He had been fighting to place an amendment banning gay marriage before Massachusetts voters as a ballot question in the 2008 election. And yesterday, the state's Democratic-controlled legislature moved the measure in that direction. The state Supreme Judicial Court made Massachusetts the only state to legalize gay marriage back in 2003. Well, for more on Mitt Romney and his presidential aspirations, Boston Globe political reporter Scott Hellman joins us first. Welcome.
Good to be here, Robin.
And let's take a look at what happened yesterday through the prism of Romney's presidential candidacy. Citizens collected signatures to put the gay marriage issue on the ballot here in Massachusetts, but the legislature has to approve that in two consecutive votes. Yesterday's was the first approval. Is that a big win for Romney?
I think it is, because it allows him on his second-to-last day in office to essentially say, look, I forced the legislature to vote on this. As people here know, the legislature had balked at voting on this thing, but they were chastened by a recent court decision, which essentially said that legislators do have a constitutional duty to vote on this gay marriage ban, and that was very much the message that Mitt Romney wanted the court to send, and he got it, and the legislators listened yesterday.
But doesn't this also shine a light or remind voters of Romney's past stand on gay rights? A letter surfaced from 1994 when he ran against Ted Kennedy for the Senate. He lost that race, but he at the time wrote a letter saying that he would be a bigger proponent of gay rights issues than even Kennedy would be.
I don't want to say he's flip-flopped, and he certainly rejects that label. What he says is that he's always been against gay marriage, which is true, but his tone on gay rights and gay and lesbian issues has been far softer. He, at one point in 94, said that he hoped that at one day gays and lesbians would be able to serve in the military. He no longer says that. Back in 94, he thought it was up to states to decide gay marriage and whether or not it should be legal. He no longer has that view. He believes that there should be a federal constitutional amendment that would ban it everywhere. There have been activists in several key Republican primary states that have said, well, wait a minute, who is this guy? He's been railing against gay marriage in the last couple of years, but is that a true feeling of the heart, or is that some sort of political calculation?
Well, Mitt Romney, the son of George Romney, the governor of Michigan, Mitt Romney gained international attention when he was head of the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. Here in Massachusetts, he became a red governor in a blue state, and he's a Mormon. How much has that been an issue as he's been testing the waters in the presidential campaign?
He's tried very hard to assuage those concerns. He's made a very important effort to court evangelicals. He invited a bunch of them, and some very prominent people, including Gary Bauer, including Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention. He invited a bunch of folks up to his house, and I think laid all this stuff out and just said, look, I want to focus on our shared values. And you heard a lot of those prominent evangelicals say afterwards that, look, we're not electing a pastor-in-chief, if you will. We're electing a commander-in-chief. Then again, I don't think we've seen the end of it by any means.
Well, and that campaign to win over evangelicals also meant that he was out of the state for 212 days in his last year, according to the Boston Globe, and he's been criticized for that. But what else has he been doing to sort of set up this presidential run?
He's been very methodical over the last 2 years, creating ground organizations in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, even Michigan to some extent. Most people who pay attention to these things will tell you that he and McCain are really the leaders on the Republican side in terms of organization. You need the folks on the ground who know who to talk to, who know how to get votes. He has methodically courted these folks, sometimes, you know, 25, 30 people at a time, sometimes 100 people at a time, but it's really paid off, and I think that if he does succeed in making a real run at the Republican nomination, I think this is going to be a big reason why.
As we leave you, just what else can his backers say that Romney accomplished here in Massachusetts that's going to help him as he heads for the White House or attempts to go to the White House?
The thing you'll hear him talk about a lot is the landmark health care bill that Massachusetts passed earlier this year with great fanfare. The bill essentially aims to extend health insurance to every Massachusetts resident, which is a pretty amazing thing, and from a Republican, no less. He also talks frequently about how he, when he came into office in 2003, he helped the state close a pretty significant budget gap without raising taxes. Now, critics will say that's not entirely true because although he didn't raise taxes per se, he raised fees, and I mean, all these things are going to be subject, of course, to interpretation. But I think you're going to see him try to put forward a message of social conservatism, fiscal conservatism. He held the line on taxes in a very blue state, was an effective governor, really fought for the things that Republicans and libertarians care about.
Scott Hellman, political reporter for the Boston Globe. Scott, thanks.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, one of the places Romney has been visiting is South Carolina, the first Southern primary state. Dr. Buddy Witherspoon is Republican National Committeeman in Columbia, South Carolina. He joins us now. And Buddy, Mitt Romney and John McCain both visited South Carolina. How has Romney been received there compared to John McCain?
Been received very well. Of course, at first, a lot of the people in South Carolina, you know, they knew he was governor of Massachusetts, but other than that, didn't know him well. But he's been here, I'd say, on numerous occasions, and therefore he's had the opportunity to meet with people. They aren't bashful. They ask the questions pretty straightforward.
Like what? Did they ask him about his Mormonism?
They did ask about that. They were concerned about that at first because I think personally they weren't real knowledgeable about the Mormonism and what have you. One of the biggest things I think that has allayed their apprehensions or what have you is that he has professed Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, and that's very important to us, especially in South Carolina.
Well, as we were just saying with Scott Hellman, Mitt Romney is leaving office with what everyone perceives as a major victory for him, with the state legislature here advancing a vote on gay marriage for the public. Romney's Political Action Committee contributed $5,000 to the group that sponsored South Carolina's so-called gay marriage ban. That passed in November.
It did, and it passed with a 78% vote, which was pretty significant, especially looking at the amount of money spent from both sides.
So obviously many South Carolina voters will look with approval at this move in Massachusetts, but I'm wondering if they may also have questions, as others in Massachusetts have, if they hear that perhaps in the past Mitt Romney has said that he is for gay rights.
We all have thoughts in the past or whatever that we change from time to time. And, of course, the past is not the problem. The main thing that people are concerned about now is the present and the future.
Where does Mitt Romney score with South Carolinians where John McCain may not? Where are some policy differences?
One difference, I would say, would be on immigration. The people of South Carolina, in fact, are not real happy with the administration and the amnesty plan that they're forging and putting forth, because we just believe that illegal immigration is against our laws and against our Constitution, and therefore we don't support illegal immigration.
Are you a Romney booster?
I do support what he's doing, no question about it. Of course, at this point in time, a lot of people have not necessarily made commitments, but they are looking hard. And like I said, Mitt Romney is probably one that's at the top of the list and a very viable candidate, no question about it.
Dr. Buddy Witherspoon, Republican National Committeeman in Columbia, South Carolina, on today's announcement that Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is forming a presidential exploration committee. Dr. Buddy Witherspoon, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
And don't forget, still to come today, we're going to put a spotlight on the film that's making many best of lists. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's launch the new year with some of your thoughts from the old. Recently, we reported on the climbers who lost their lives in Oregon and in China, and we spoke again with adventure writer David Roberts, author of On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. Roberts says he doubts that when climbers die doing what they love, that's any solace to the survivors. And listener Laura Ordway agrees. She writes, "Thank you to David Roberts for once again taking the unpopular position in the climbing community. As a past climber and guide, it took the birth of my children for me to realize what impact my climbing life had on my entire family. I still support my hard men and women friends who choose to climb the toughest routes on the most challenging mountains, though I've made the decision not to take these risks anymore. But I no longer allow them to be naive or flippant with me about their lives or about what the impact of their deaths will have on me and their families." Bob Bentley also wrote after we spoke with a rescuer in Oregon who suggested that climbers might carry personal locating devices. Bob writes, "I just looked up the cost and found the cheapest device at about $500. Now, people generally won't pay that price. And don't we all need to be careful about relying too much on technology? As an Appalachian Mountain Club member, I've heard stories of people calling on cell phones to ask for help to get off the mountain because it's getting dark. The last thing we need to do is overburden the great search and rescue people. Cell phones have started to do that. Personal locating devices could also." Well, we also recently reported on the decline in incidences of breast cancer, potentially because of a reduction in the number of menopausal women taking hormone replacement therapy. At the time, I said some women still need to take HRTs to offset the symptoms of menopause, and that brought this call from Jane Street of Massachusetts.
Robin just referred to menopause as having symptoms. Many of us are calling them signs now. Menopause is a natural process. It's not a disease. And the weight of the medical profession does medicalize it and call it a disease, at least inferentially, by using the term symptoms.
Morgan Andrews of Philadelphia took issue with the interview we did with comedian Harry Shearer. Harry said his book, Not Enough Indians, is actually a condemnation of white Americans pretending to be Indians in order to get gambling rights. But Morgan says the topic is too sensitive for parody. He writes, "It's bad enough we have professional sports teams such as the Atlanta Braves and the Washington Redskins, and every time I see someone sporting the toothy, crimson-faced Cleveland Indians logo, it's like the decapitated head of a conquered enemy's being paraded in front of me. I'm afraid that Harry Shearer's book about a town full of white people who pose as an Indian tribe perpetuates this insensitivity. There's been a lot of coverage of the recent summit in Iran that denounced the Jewish Holocaust as myth. As a Jew, I'm as appalled by the treatment of the Native American Holocaust." Well, we also got this call after Deb Becker spoke with a Selective Service System spokesperson about future plans to test the draft. That sent Jeff Luby of Carlisle, Massachusetts, to the phone.
Despite the fact that the Selective Service individual at least three times indicated that the draft trial or whatever they're going to do in terms of doing a test would relate only to men, it's very interesting to me that the interviewers never pick up on that and say, well, what about the women? The fact is, we live in a very equal rights kind of environment, which is fine, but it needs to work both ways, it seems to me.
And finally, we received this New Year's wish from John Ingraham. He writes, "Robin, I just want to thank you and the whole Here and Now team for the whole year's worth of fun and entertainment we've just had. I was driving along listening to your interview with whistling champion Heert Chatru. I've been a whistler since I was a kid, often maligned and abused. I had no idea so many people were interested. Thank you once again for enlightening us. You keep us informed. Your stories are usually starting points for me to do research and buy a whole new pile of books. If I ever win the Powerball, I swear I will underwrite your show. Happy New Year. Looking forward to 2007. Well, Happy New Year to you as well, and we're going to keep our fingers crossed for that Powerball. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. Much more ahead, all of 2007, here and now. Young, it's here and now. Films about dysfunctional families are a dime a dozen. There's plenty of raw material, after all. But this year's Little Miss Sunshine put a wacky family in a road movie, squeezing six oddballs into a sputtering VW bus bound for a beauty pageant for prepubescent girls, a comic desperation rarely seen on screen.
Everybody push! All right. Here we go! Push! Okay, I just want everyone here to know that I am the preeminent Drew scholar in the United States.
Little Miss Sunshine was the sleeper hit of the year, an independent film that landed on most critics' best of lists. Here and Now's Andrea Shea spoke to the filmmaking couple who made Little Miss Sunshine a family affair in more ways than one.
Before making Little Miss Sunshine, co-directors Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton looked back at episodes of the 1973 PBS series, An American Family.
It was the first, you know, I hate to even use the term reality program, where they followed a family for a whole year, and then they made 13 episodes or something. And we saw it when we were kids, and we went back to the UCLA archives and watched this documentation of An American Family, and it was really influential.
Because it was a brutally honest portrayal of family life, sort of an anti-Brady Bunch. Dayton thinks Little Miss Sunshine is like that too, despite being fictional and a comedy. But inevitably, Dayton says all family road movies are held up against the benchmark of the subgenre.
Definitely National Lampoon Vacation has come up a lot, and hopefully people can see how different two films with similar plot lines can be.
The Chevy Chase vehicle Vacation and Little Miss Sunshine have a few things in common, including a beat-up car, desert travel, a few tense arguments, and a chirpy grandparent in the back seat. But the grandpa in Little Miss Sunshine has one up on Grandma Griswold. He snorts heroin and is addicted to porn. The father in Little Miss Sunshine peddles a nine-step program for success without much success of his own. His bleak teenage son takes a vow of silence in honor of Nietzsche. Olive, the cherubic 7-year-old daughter, dreams of being a beauty queen. There's the Proust scholar uncle who attempts suicide after being dumped by his gay lover, and the mom, ever stable, honest, and supportive.
Why did you want to kill yourself?
No, don't answer the question, Frank.
Richard.
Don't answer it.
Richard.
He's not going to answer the question, Frank.
I wanted to kill myself.
Don't listen to him.
Richard. I was very unhappy.
He's a sick man. He's a sick in his head man.
Richard.
I'm sorry. I don't think it's an appropriate conversation for a 7-year-old.
Well, she's going to find out anyway.
Okay.
Olive soon finds out she's been accepted to compete in the Little Miss Sunshine beauty pageant. Then the whole family reluctantly crams into their VW bus to get Olive to the contest on time. And while the plot's a little zany, directors Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris say there's nothing unusual about the Hoovers.
I don't really know what a dysfunctional family is other than just a regular family. I think all families have moments of dysfunction and moments where things come together.
I think we related to them, you know, just how tough it is to get along sometimes because families are an oddball collection of characters, you know, that otherwise wouldn't probably be spending time except for the fact that they're blood related.
Faris and Dayton speak from experience. While they aren't blood-related, they are married. With three children between them, they admit Little Miss Sunshine hits them where they live. Family life, they say, is a matter of forced acceptance.
Because you can be at your worst with your family, that's part of what's great about family, is there aren't that many places where you can sort of be at your lowest and not be kicked out, you know?
Yeah. It's a permanent membership.
Yeah.
The members of the Hoover family are put through the emotional ringer in Little Miss Sunshine. Like a good horror film, the story swings from one extreme to another.
I think life is a roller coaster ride. If you have a family, I think having children particularly, you know, you realize how quickly the tone of the moment can change from a complete drama to absurd comedy.
There's no genre for that. It's just that there's some kind of truth in it.
Actress Toni Collette is the patient mom in Little Miss Sunshine. In this scene, she plays the peacekeeper between her husband and brother.
I feel sorry for you.
You do? Good.
Yeah, I do. Because sarcasm is the refuge of losers.
It is? Really?
Yep.
Sarcasm is losers trying to bring winners down to their level, and that's step four in the program.
Wow, Richard, you really opened my eyes to what a loser I am. How much do I owe you for those pearls of
wisdom? Oh, that one's on the house, buddy.
It is?
Yeah, it's okay, on the house.
Guys,
that's on the house.
Hey,
wow.
Guys,
that was
great.
For free.
No charge.
Stop You're it. Not going to charge.
Stop it.
Colette says in family, everyone assumes a position.
Everyone plays a certain role. I think most families do that. And perhaps the story here is that people step outside their roles and each member sees each other for who they really are. And I think it's ultimately very freeing for all of them.
Directors Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris stepped outside their usual roles by making Little Miss Sunshine. For more than 20 years, the couple has directed award-winning music videos and documentaries for REM, Jane's Addiction, Beck, and others. While this is their feature film debut, Dayton says directing an ensemble of seasoned actors, including Colette, Greg Kinnear, Steve Carell, and Alan Arkin, is a lot like working with a long-standing band, such as the Red Hot Chili Peppers, led by singer Anthony Kiedis.
You never have to tell Anthony Kiedis how to move. You talk about the setting and then you let him do what he does. And Alan Arkin is a master. You don't need to ever tell him how to be funny.
Or sincere. Here's Arkin's character with his granddaughter.
Grandpa?
Yeah.
Am I pretty?
Olive, you are the most beautiful girl in the whole world.
You're just saying that?
No, I'm not. I'm madly in love with you. And it's not because of your brains or your personality. It's because you're beautiful, inside and out.
And even though a children's beauty pageant drives the action in Little Miss Sunshine, Faris says that's not what it's about.
The film really is about the contests that we put ourselves in throughout life, not just this one climactic moment.
Getting Little Miss Sunshine made was a contest in its own right. It took 5 years to cobble together the financing, but in the end, the husband and wife say working together on the film was far easier than running their own family.
The crews always listen to us the first time. You don't have to ask twice, but our kids...
A set is like a super functional family. You know, like everybody listens, they do what they're supposed to be doing, they work really hard, you know. I think... You know, raising a family prepared us for making this movie, but it didn't necessarily make it any easier to make the movie.
And, like watching a grown kid head off to college, Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton say it isn't easy to let their film, Little Miss Sunshine, go.
I fell in love again. All things go, drove to Chicago, all things know.
That was Here and Now's Andrea Shea on Little Miss Sunshine, which is now out on DVD. And by the way, we're listening to the music of Stoofy and Stevens, and it's from the film.
I made a lot of mistakes in my mind, in my mind.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. And our intern is Katie Falsigno, who thought she'd launch the new year by leaving us. It's her last day. Thank you, Katie. It isn't easy letting you go, but you'll be back. They all come back. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
New York, in a van with my friend. We slept in parking lots. I don't mind, I was in love with the place in my mind.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.